some of you may be familiar with or have read about, or if you're like me, have a series of books collecting dust on your shelves called Eat This, Not That. What began as a series of articles for men magazines, David Zizinko and his partner Matt Gulling had a series of articles that turned into all these books with colorful covers. Eat This, Not That. Based on a pretty common, it would seem, premise that if you exchange a diet of saturated fat and sugar and sodium for the alternative of higher fiber and more protein, you will lose weight and become healthier. So instead of a diet that asks you to restrict what you eat, it just asks for you to exchange something that may not be as good for you that with something that may be far better. Anybody try that? Okay, we're in church. I know we're not supposed to, you know, talk about these things, about confessing our physical issues, but I found that to be helpful and sound advice and good advice at times. I remember that old computer adage, garbage in. We were told that in computer science as we were trying to learn these management programs in college, that now I guess they've decided the American public is just not skilled enough to manage. And so we have smartphones that are actually smarter than we are. Oftentimes I have my phone and my 25-year-old says, you look like an old person using a cell phone. Yes, I am. And while this principle of investment and return works in nutrition and fiscal management, I would suggest it also works in our spiritual lives. The 2 Corinthians 4:16 says that while the outward nature, our physical being, is wasting away, the inner nature is being renewed day by day. That we have responsibility over these two identities, our physical identity and our spiritual identity. And isn't it odd that the identity that seems to get the most attention and most concern and most worry is that part of our lives that is prone to disease and death? Well, that part of our lives that is destined for eternity is often neglected and not considered and not at all imagined. What does it mean to manage your spiritual lives with as much dedication as we think about our physical appearance? What does it mean for us in this consuming kind of way of living that what we consume may be helpful or destructive for our ongoing, emerging, ever-transforming spiritual identities? If you remember last week, we are walking with Jesus through Matthew 13 and 14, and we're remembering that things aren't going too well for Jesus at this stage in the story. That we have at the end of chapter 13, Jesus going to his hometown in Nazareth and being ill-received, so that those who knew him best were offended by him. Is this really the little kid we saw grow up? And it said at the end of chapter 13 of the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus really couldn't do anything with these people because of their disbelief. And now we have read a portion of chapter 14, but we have not looked at the beginning verses. A story that is so difficult that we shouldn't bring it up in polite company. A story that even the lectionary wants to avoid, but a story that is crucial for us to understand the rest of the scriptures that we have read today. For chapter 14 opens up with the shocking news of the horrible death of John the Baptist. John was the forerunner, the bridge between the older prophets of doom and the new confession of Jesus as God's special messenger and provider of a holy, W-H-O-L-L-Y, and holy, H-O-L-Y, new way. Jesus was presenting a new way for those who wish to relate to God and to follow Him, to live and move and have their being. But John the Baptist runs into grave trouble with those in positions of established and inherited power. Allies to Imperial Rome, King Herod and his cohorts are more in love with authority and their own pleasure than any concern for the plight of their own people. And John has greatly irritated them by calling them out in the public square. How dare he? Who does he think he is? He's pointed out their immorality. He has charged them with betraying their own people. He has spoken out loudly and often on topics that others have just whispered in private. So I ask you, what do the important people of great authority do when they're questioned, when they're accused of abusing their power? Do they simply say, oh, you know you're right, I'm so sorry, I'll make amends, thank you for pointing out the error of my ways, I'll make a quick course correction, I'll change, I'll do better? Do they admit their wrongdoing? Do they adjust their ways? Or do they do everything they can to try and silence their accusers, to avoid their responsibility? John is arrested. And then in a gruesome turn of events, he is beheaded. And his severed head is placed on a platter and passed around at Herod's birthday party as just another dish being served and enjoyed. Can you imagine anything so disgusting, sadistic, and cruel? Such a ghastly and horrifying incident should turn the stomachs of anyone with a conscience. And now we flash to Jesus. As it appears, this news is fresh in his ears, and as it's being spread throughout the crowds. And I want you to push the pause button on the story right here. For this is a crucial point of the movement. How would Jesus respond? How should Jesus respond in the light of such terrible things? We can understand his desire to be alone. What do you do when you hear awful news? What do you do when you're hurting? What do you do when one of your family members that you love has been treated this way so unfairly and something so despicable and terrible has happened to them? How would you respond to an act of gross injustice? Especially if you have the power of Moses and the charisma of King David and the loyalty of the crowds, there's a lot of options on the table. Especially if you're concerned about the suffering of the masses and the continued and unchecked abuse of an imperial and economically dominated super system that seems to delight in crushing others to build up their own power, who can quite literally get away with murder. What would you do? Especially if you're the Son of God, charged with straightening out a crooked world. If ever there was an opportune moment, ripe for taking, this is one of those moments. Here it is. Shouldn't the new Messiah, Moses, confront Pharaoh? Wouldn't a returned King David rise up an army and take control? How about a resurrected Elijah calling fire down from heaven? Maybe you should go to the press with your story. What if you organized a protest? Maybe you could lash out on Facebook or send a scathing tweet. I noticed at Jesus of Naz 316, there was this tweet sent this week from Jesus. Never spoke English. Never had a high-tech job. Might explain why I'm never welcomed in the good old USA. Is it time to march on the Capitol? Plan an insurrection? Grow deeply bitter? Give up hope? Take up drinking? Believe no change is possible? Is it time to resign? Is it time to resist? What does this time call for? And with this background fresh in your minds, now you can go push play and listen again to verse 14. We read, "When Jesus went ashore, he saw a great crowd. He had compassion for them and cured their sick." When Jesus went ashore and saw a great crowd, he had compassion for them and cured their sick. Jesus turns his hurt into a means of healing and help. Drop a pin right there in the map narrative of Scripture. What do you do when you're hurting? What do you do when you're bewildered? What do you do when you're overwhelmed with life? What do you do when it looks like everything that you stand for and hope for in the world is coming crashing down around you? What do you do? How will you respond? Jesus has compassion and turns to those who have need and helps them. The Catholic mystic Richard Rohr points out an observation from French anthropologist Renard Girard, 1923 to 2015, who held that Jesus is the most unlikely founder of a religion because he doesn't encourage any forms of sacrifice except the letting go of one's own egocentricity. Religion, he says, normally begins by making a distinction between the pure and the impure, telling us to sacrifice the impure so that we can be pure. Given that premise, Jesus undoes conventional definitions of religion by doing the most amazing thing he can. Jesus finds God among the impure instead of the pure. A God that's reserved not only for the elite, but a God who is for the many. So now we can consider the feeding miracle of the 5,000. Let me briefly tell you that this is the only miracle story that is in all four Gospels. And Matthew and Mark each have added an additional feeding miracle of feeding the 4,000. Jesus, who possesses a power unlike none other, will not use his power for revenge. He will not use his power for violence, but only for the good, for the relieving of suffering, for the quieting of hunger, for the meeting of a person's truest and deepest needs. And so in the chapter of Matthew 14, we have been presented with two meals. One in the halls of wealth and influence, with only the finest cuisine and only the very best selections of food and drink, served up to those David Luce calls the lifestyles of the rich and shameless. At this feast, sick laughter and manipulation and a dangerous display of the kind of intimidation tangible for those who don't fall into line. And the other meal that's being offered is focused on mercy and inclusion. Enough, plenty, just enough, so that anyone can be invited, no matter who they are, no matter where they've been, no matter what they've done, no matter how much money's in their bank account, no matter whether or not they used fresh deodorant that morning, no matter what color their skin or where they come from or what language they speak, no matter how they are connected or not connected, no matter how skilled they are or how talented they are or how intelligent they are, Jesus looks upon the crowds. Jesus looks upon us. And he has compassion. This meal is a miracle of grace, celebrating the extravagance of a God of abundance who doesn't hoard or hide blessings or reserve them just for a few. And Matthew is foreshadowing the community of the church and the simple act of Jesus in this miracle feeding story of taking bread, of looking up to heaven, of blessing the bread and breaking it and giving it to those who are around him. An early type of Last Supper, with men and women and children running around everywhere. WWJD. What would Jesus do? It's still a valid question. Now, eventually, Jesus will go to Jerusalem. Jesus will speak truth to power. Jesus will stand up in love in a time of oppression and fear. But first, Jesus will invest himself with the poor. Jesus will address the suffering of the marginalized and the wounded. Jesus will lean into the community of faithful belonging. Jesus will be filled with compassion and ask all who wish to follow him to do the same. For you and I, in today's world, in this culture, in this society, we are surrounded by a smorgasbord of choices. We're not impoverished. We're not hungry in the wilderness with nothing to eat as the sun falls from the sky. We have more time and money and food choices and leisure options than most of the royalty of years gone by. But with all these choices before us, are we filling our bodies, our physical bodies and our spiritual bodies, with nothing more than junk food? Jesus cares about our consumption. Jesus purposes to fill us with good things. Later this month, I hope to offer you a reading list of some books that have been important in the spiritual lives of others that you know here in this church. Sort of eat this, not that, read this, not that kind of list. Because there's a lot of books, I think, that have the name Jesus and God that may be more like cotton candy than real substance for your souls. So, as kids go back to school, anticipate this syllabus of helpful reading, reflective Christianity, kinds of deeper kinds of experiencing life in a deeper way as you prepare to move into the fall and the new church year. But it seems we're caught in these choices. I was talking to one church member this morning who is on the series of medication, and we realized that to take medicine for this condition means that you're going to get this side effect, so you need to take a pill for that side effect, which then leads to this side effect, which then you have to take medicine for that side effect, and all of a sudden you're taking all this medication. And that pill that is offered to you on a daily basis in our culture that says fear and suspicion and oppression and convenience and the shortcut has all kinds of side effects. The other pill that's offered to us has one word blazoned upon it. It says compassion. Which pill will you eat?